Hi, and welcome to the third episode of Onward, the Fundrise podcast, where you can find out more about what's happening at Fundrise and where you'll hear some in-depth conversations about the big trends affecting the U.S. and global economies. My name is Cardiff Garcia. I am an economics podcaster at Bazaar Audio, and I am joined once again, as we are in every episode, by Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. Ben, hi.
Hey, Cardiff. Good to see you today.
Yeah, I'm excited about this chat. Ben, before we started recording, you told me that the topic of the day would be private equity, the history and the nature of private equity and where it's going now. Why don't you start by explaining to the audience just what it is that interests you so much about this topic, why you wanted to discuss it today?
Well, so at the last podcast, we sort of ended with teeing up the idea we should talk a little bit about Fundrise itself rather than about our investments. So that's what I'm going to try to do in this episode if I can. And the way I think about it is that when you're starting a business, you want to solve a big problem. You want to find something that's a big problem. And then a great business is one that's a problem that's hidden or a problem that most people don't recognize. Famous or infamous venture capitalist Peter Thiel, he has this question he asks everybody in every interview, which is, tell me something you believe that everyone else believes the opposite.
Okay.
So mine is something like, we're at peak private equity, basically. Like, its best days are like behind it, even though it's a multi-trillion dollar industry that basically the essence of the story of sort of the value creation of what private equity is, what it's doing, it's actually like no longer true. It was true at one point, but it's changed. But the industry is still stuck in the past, and that essentially technology can do it better.
Okay.
That's the big idea.
I love it. So that is a very provocative way to sell the rest of the episode. In other words, you think that we're at peak private equity. You think that the fact that private equity may have started running its course means that there's opportunities to do things differently. And that is where Fundrise comes into the mix. So let's go ahead and back up and let's start by talking about some private equity basics, okay? The things that people should know about the way that private equity works. And I mean, here's one thing I know. Typically, investors in private equity funds tend to be either big institutions, so like, you know, endowments, foundations, or they tend to be fairly well-off individuals, people that meet very high minimum thresholds for how much money they have or how much money they make. That's one thing that's important to know. What are some of the other traits of private equity that you think are relevant for this discussion?
Let's start with what is private equity for a minute. Most investors, when they think of investing, they think of investing in the stock market. Publicly traded stocks, maybe they buy publicly traded mutual funds, ETFs. So that's the public markets. But a lot of assets, like a lot of companies, are not public. They're private, right? They're not publicly traded. And to invest in a private asset is a lot more difficult, right? You can't just hit a button and buy it. So that's really basically what private equity's job is to go buy things that are not publicly traded. And the theory, and I think a lot of the fact, is that because they're not publicly traded, it's less efficient, there's more opportunity, and you can get better returns. So that's the big wrapper of what private equity is. And then inside of it, there's actually sort of this long history of having a lot of regulations around who's allowed to invest in it. So most private equity funds only allow essentially what I call institutions investing. And the typical check size is in the millions. Mm-hmm. And so that's true because of the regulations. And also the nature of raising the money is done in person, by salespeople, by principals. And so, of course, you're not going to fly across the country for $100. It wouldn't make sense. So there's a few reasons why the check writers in the past have been big check writers.
Yeah, when you say the check size is usually about $1 million, what you mean is that if an investor wants to invest in a private equity fund that's raising money and is going to buy a company, that the minimum check size will often be in the millions, which is just one reason why you can see that like a typical sort of mom and pop retail investor who invests in the stock market just won't have access to it. So are there any other traits about private equity that you think are important here? And I'll also ask if there are any specific traits about real estate private equity that people should know about.
There's lots of different kinds of private investment. So private equity, where they buy whole companies. There's also real estate private equity, they buy real estate assets. Mm-hmm. There's also private credit, where you're lending to private companies or private small businesses. Venture capital is a private investment because you're investing into private tech companies. So it's all, broadly speaking, private equity. I'm going to mostly focus on real estate private equity. A lot of the things I'm saying, I think, are true, broadly speaking, but I know more about real estate. I mean, Fundrise is a real estate investment platform today. So that's one caveat. And then let me just get into a little bit of sort of what's the work of a private equity fund, right? It's usually actually like just three people, right? It's a partner and some analysts. Maybe there's a few partners and a few analysts, but it's actually not many people. Like Sequoia, which is number one venture fund, one of the co-founders says, we're just 20 chickens running around in the back. It's just like a few people. And those people are usually MBAs, and they go out and analyze markets. They analyze investments, deals. They pick them. They try to buy them. A lot of times it's difficult to buy something that's not publicly traded. They do a lot of financing. And then they analyze essentially like ways that they think that maybe I'll add value, and then they sell the asset. So that's basically what they're doing. And then I'll add one more point. So what's the software rails of the private investment industry? So what basically is the software rails of finance?
Yeah. What do you mean by software rails?
So what software do these companies use to do analysis and make decisions is 1995 Microsoft Office, right? It's Microsoft Excel. That's the software that the entire financial industry uses to make their decisions.
Yeah.
It helps you understand how antiquated the industry is.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. And you said something important there, which is that we're not just going to be talking about what's traditionally known as private equity. We're talking about the entirety of the private investment landscape, which does include venture capital, which is somewhat similar to private equity, except it doesn't use debt. And we're talking about real estate private equity, which, as you said, involves somewhat similar structure in many cases to private equity, other kinds of private equity, except that these funds are now buying real estate assets. They're buying like commercial properties. Sometimes I guess they might be buying residential properties, and they'll be trying to turn those properties into profitable assets so that later on they might be able to either sell them, or I guess they could just keep making the money from them if they turn them into very profitable companies themselves. I guess you could keep them for a while. But in any case, I just wanted to make sure before we move on to the history of private equity, that's exactly what we're talking about.
And then just to tee it up, if you think about finance over the last 100 years, the arc of history is democratizing finance. It used to be that only, you know, Joseph Kennedy could trade on the stock market. Now everybody can trade on the stock market. Mutual funds, options, I mean, trading, all of that has been slowly but surely made more accessible, lower cost over many decades. So the broad private investment industry, which you might think is actually larger than the public markets, like wasn't available to individuals in any meaningful way. And that just doesn't make sense.
That's a good point about the sort of ongoing democratization of finance. And it sounds like what you're saying here is that just as it used to be that only rich people could invest in the stock market, but now we have index funds, we have exchange traded funds. There's just a lot of ways that small investors can now invest in the stock market. The same thing could happen to the private investment landscape, that right now it's still kind of for rich people or for big institutions. And you think it's possible that over time, and this is one of Fundrise's missions, perhaps, to make it possible for like a normal person to also be able to invest in private investments, right?
Right.
Excellent. Okay, great. Let's talk about the relevant history of private investments. And I don't know how far back you want to go. I think the origins of the modern private equity industry were roughly in the 1980s, which was like the time of the movie Wall Street and the book Bonfire of the Vanities. It was the Wild West of investors taking over companies. Those companies would try to fight back from being taken over, all that stuff. The venture capitalists, I think, became especially prominent in the 1990s with the dot-com boom, but they were also there before. How far back do you want to go? Like, where do you want to start in terms of the relevant history of private investments?
So because I'm going to focus on real estate, I'm going to start in the 80s as well.
Okay.
But I think private equity and private equity real estate are almost contemporaneous. So to understand anything, you need to understand its history. And so with real estate or real estate private equity, past is prologue. So I'm going to look at this two different ways. One with the general context and one around specific events. So in the 80s and most of real estate before that, investors were individuals. Investors were families. Investors were basically people who invested through accountants and lawyers. And most of real estate was about harvesting losses you could actually sell losses in real estate, and real estate was basically a way to shelter profits. So it's a whole different world before 1987 when Reagan changed the laws. It was a 1986 tax reform under Brady, and they got rid of that.
Secretary of the Treasury then, Nicholas Brady, I believe.
Right.
Okay.
So they changed the law, and the way all real estate was raised, which is called syndication, that stops working because you can no longer have tax loss harvesting. So the entire real estate market implodes.
Okay. So a law changes and makes it harder for certain types of investments to actually help you out, because a lot of people used to just use real estate as a way to essentially game their taxes. Is that the relevant history here?
Well, if you bought an asset mostly for the losses, you could literally sell your losses. And that was no longer useful. You couldn't apply those losses from a tax point of view.
Right.
Then all of a sudden, the real estate value craters. And so that causes a cascade where most of the lenders to that real estate were SNLs, savings and loans. Mm-hmm. So then what happens as a result is the SNL crisis. And the SNL crisis now is ancient history for most people, but actually way more banks failed in the SNL crisis than in the 2008 financial crisis. I think in the 2008 financial crisis, a couple hundred banks failed. And in the SNL crisis, 8,000 banks failed.
Yeah, these savings and loans. And which, by the way, the crisis lasted for years. It was at least partly responsible for a recession that happened in the early 1990s as well, which had all kinds of interesting political ramifications. So that's what was happening in the 1980s. Take us a little bit further into the future then. What happened in the 1990s? How did the industry recover? And what did the private equity real estate landscape sort of look like then as it sort of resurrected from the SNL crisis?
Well, there wasn't really real estate private equity as we know of it in the 80s. And so the government takes an approach to the SNL crisis that was very different than it does today. And a lot of the reasons why you've seen the bailouts and the fiscal stimulus and TARP and all these sorts of things in the last crisis is because the lessons learned in 1989 and 1990 and 1991, because they took a completely diametrically opposed approach back then. So what they did was there were 8,000 banks that failed, and the government foreclosed on all of them, took them all over. And then most of those real estate assets had been highly levered, had been in a boom economy. There was an oversupply of real estate at that time. And so most of those assets ended up getting foreclosed on by the SNLs. And so you're talking about each bank owning hundreds of properties, maybe thousands, and 8,000 banks owned by the government. So you're talking about the government ending up owning hundreds of thousands of properties.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the government says, okay, what do we do with this? So they form something called the Resolution Trust Corporation, the RTC. And they form this entity to essentially own all these assets and dispose of them.
And then you need buyers for it. So who were the buyers?
Right. So how do you sell hundreds of thousands of properties? Like not one at a time. So they turned around and said, we got to sell like a pool of 1,000 properties. Who can buy 1,000 properties? Well, most individuals, most like wealthy families can't buy 1,000 properties. Oh, you need a pool to buy a pool.
Okay.
So they formed this pool, private equity pool, and the first buyer of the RTC's like first sale was a partnership, 50% Blackstone, 50% Goldman's Whitehall. It was sponsored by this guy, Joe Robert, and they bought this pool. And those types of pools being sold by the government, I mean, they were buying them at pennies on the dollar.
Yeah.
So all of the private equity funds that sort of launched basically to take advantage of this opportunity made a fortune.
Right.
The government essentially created the real estate private equity industry. And just to give you like a list of names, the kind of companies that all got started in that period. So Blackstone started in the late 80s. Carlyle started in the late 80s. Apollo started in the late 80s.
These are very famous private equity firms that we still know of today and are still quite active. They were raising a lot of money to buy these properties for super cheap because the government was getting rid of them at fire sale prices. And they ended up making a fortune on those investments for themselves and, of course, for their investors.
So okay. I think that's the specific events.
Okay.
But let me just give you a general context because it really helps you understand what private equity does and what's its value proposition. So imagine 1992, no internet. No mobile phones. Okay, Cardiff, go to Seattle and figure out what properties to buy. Which ones should we buy? How do we buy them? You're going to fly to Seattle. What are you going to do? You're going to go to the library and look up old Seattle Times newspapers on a microfiche?
Because you need to find out if these properties are any good somehow, right?
Exactly. There's no data. You're talking about having to cold call people, having tons of lunches, random meetings. I mean, the opaqueness, like the inefficiency in the market is just so hard for people to imagine. I mean, back then, right, newspapers were the sources of information. There were local papers. Buffalo had multiple newspapers. There's local retail. If you go to Miracle Mile in Chicago, it used to have local retail. So is that local retail good or not? And if you're in New York, you have no idea. Every street was different. You used to have local television stations, local radio stations, local banking. Everything was regionalized. And so the need for private equity to go and figure out the data, the deals, gather the dollars was so clear. It was absolute necessity. There was an incredible opportunity to the government unloading these properties, but the need for private equity was a necessity.
Yeah, in part because the technology at the time, certainly by today's standards, was so archaic. You didn't have these huge, you know, databases. You didn't have ways of feeding all this information and finding it out.
Just to imagine, you go to Seattle, how do you get around? You need a map.
Yeah.
You need a paper map. I mean, that's how inefficient the world was. And I don't think it's that long ago. I mean, from your telling earlier on, a typical fund is a 10-year life. So the funds in the early 90s that killed it birthed the next fund cycle in the early 2000s. And then birthed the next fund cycle in the 2010s. So it's really only three fund cycles ago. And most of the people who started these companies, you know, Barry Sternlicht of Starwood, he still runs Starwood. Starwood's one of the biggest private equity funds in the country. He starts in the early 90s. Same with Leon Black, Steve Schwartzman, the Carlyle founders just retired. So the same people are running these companies who recognized the opportunity and built multi-billion dollar companies since then.
Yeah. And so they had this run in the 1990s, and certainly in real estate, from your telling, it sounds like it was enormously profitable. There was, of course, eventually the dot-com collapse, and there was a brief recession in the early 2000s. Private equity overall in the mid-2000s had an unbelievable renaissance. Again, I'd love to ask you, what was happening with real estate private equity in the 2000s in that second fund cycle, as you described it? Or third fund cycle, whichever, second or third, I guess, depending on
that's
where you start.
Generally a second fund cycle of these major private equity funds. And yeah, Blackstone bought Hilton. They bought Equity Office. That was a real estate crisis. And you saw Lehman Brothers, who was very active, go bankrupt. But one of the things that I think really validated private equity is a lot of these investments actually paid off. Hilton actually returned a 3x return for the investors that Blackstone bought at the peak of the cycle. Same with Equity Office. So the best of the best actually performed through the 2008 financial crisis. And that's one of the reasons you've seen them grow to hundreds of billions of dollars.
So that's in the 2000s. How do you characterize the kind of post-great financial crisis decade for real estate private equity and private equity generally?
The broader macro trend happening from the 1990s is just a financialization of the markets. So sure, private equity grew to trillions, but so did public REITs.
Real quick, real estate investment trust, just in case some of our listeners don't know what that is.
Publicly traded real estate investment trusts, there were something like 6 billion in the 80s, and now there's a trillion.
Yeah.
So the CMBS, which is a form of securitization, a kind of a bond financing, RMBS, if you ever read Liar's Poker about the birth of the asset-backed security. So there's a massive financialization of assets over the period. So private equity, no exception, extremely successful, riding that macro trend. That's why I talk about a lot of what's true about private equity is true about all of finance. And it's a lot of those sectors are not done by people anymore. It's done by machines. So let's go to the next question about how does it really work?
Sure. Yeah, the history tour is over anyway. So let's talk about how the industry organizes itself, especially in the context of what problem it is meant to be solving, what it is actually saying that it offers. How would you characterize how the private equity industry essentially sells itself? And then we'll discuss sort of the merits of those selling points.
So when I think about analyzing something, I always think about its structure and its incentives. Like the fancy way of saying this is ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, that the nature of something will be dictated by how it's structured. Like a fish will swim, a bird will fly, right? So you have to look at the structure of the industry or the value chain.
And what do you mean by value chain exactly?
I often think of the investment business like a supply chain business. Everybody's familiar with supply chains these days. So money has a supply chain as well. So money moves through a supply chain or value chain. So it starts with a person like Cardiff has money, and he's going to put it somewhere, right? So I'm going to go back to the 90s because actually most of the structure of the industry is set in the 90s, and that structure is still true today. Where did people put that money in the 90s? They put their money into pension funds. Maybe they actually put their money in insurance companies. And so those pension funds and insurance companies back then, right, they gather those dollars with cold calls, phone calls, local branch offices. So the first step in the value chain or the supply chain of money is actually aggregating dollars together, because your monthly paycheck, some part of it is going to get saved, and it makes its way to the bank, it makes its way to an insurance company, it makes its way to a pension fund. They aggregate the dollars. That's the first part of the structure of the value chain. Those aggregators, which in the financial world, they call them institutions, and then again, like a California State Teachers, MetLife, or it could be, you know, JP Morgan.
Right. Pension funds are institutions. They are institutional investors, in other words, right?
Institutions are really just aggregators of dollars.
Right.
And that's their job. That's the function they provide to finance. And then the next step in the value chain, especially in the 90s and 2000s, was allocators. So an investment fund would raise money from these institutions for a strategy like real estate, or it might be venture capital. It could be a very specific strategy like distressed debt, but it's they basically, an allocator or a fund manager goes into these institutions and says, you have all this money, you don't know how to invest it, your job's aggregating dollars actually mostly, we know how to invest it, we're going to allocate it for you. And that's the fund. And they fly to Seattle and say, hey, I need somebody who knows about Seattle, because I don't know anything about Seattle and I have to allocate all this money. I'm going to find a local operator, a real estate operator, real estate partner who knows about apartments in Seattle or office buildings in Seattle, and they're going to fund them. And the local operator will do the construction, the development, the leasing, the project management, the things on the ground that you need to be local to know how to do. So the three parts of the value chain are the aggregator, the allocator, and the operator.
What you're saying is that from the time I have a dollar from my paycheck and I decide that I want to invest it, to the moment when that dollar is actually invested in something specific, like a property in Seattle or whatever, that dollar has to pass through all these different administrative and logistical processes, each of which, by the way, includes like hiring people that they have to employ to pass that money along, technology that they have to invest in. And so it's costly, it's expensive. So by the time that dollar, what started as a dollar in my pocket, is actually invested in an asset in Seattle, it's been essentially like a feed away, right? Like there are these fees that it has to pass through, and it might not be a dollar anymore. It's a very expensive sort of way of doing things. And back then, when the technology wasn't awesome, the value chain was like quite long and it could be a little bit expensive. And it sounds like what you're saying is if you could find a way to shrink the value chain, then more of my dollar would actually be invested. And that means I would also get more money back once that investment pays off. Is that what we're setting up here?
I'm setting that up. Let me just caveat that with back in the 90s and even the 2000s, the market was so inefficient. There was so much opportunity that even though there was an expensive value chain, you captured so much value.
You could still make a ton of money.
It was worth it. Yeah. It was worth it. Yes. And we're talking about the dollar going through, but just I think people also can't imagine the 90s because I was there. So I was like, yeah.
And by the way, when you say that the market was inefficient, what you mean is that there was a lot of stuff you could invest in that was underpriced and you could still find it. And that meant that you would make money on those investments over time because they were so cheap. And so even if you had to go through this long value chain and it wasn't ideal, you'd still make a lot of money, right? So that's the basic framing of what was happening in the 90s.
Right. There's a lot of hidden value that got captured. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to put another context to help people realize how different it was. So in 1990, total U.S. household wealth was $20 trillion. Okay, now, 2022, it's $140 trillion. Right. There's $120 trillion more dollars than there was in the 1990s, right? So what does more dollars mean? That likely means more competition for opportunity. So there's a lot of things that have driven the market to be more efficient or, yes, or smaller, tighter returns, if you will. Private equity is the second step in the three-step chain. The first step is the aggregator. Second step is the private equity fund. The third step is the operator.
So in that sort of context, what was private equity's sort of proposition? What was it that they were trying to say that they could do that couldn't be done by anybody else?
So first, people underestimate how important it is, but they had to gather the dollars. You had to fly to raise the money. And you raise that money by hand. You raise that money by flying all over the country, all over the world, pitching people, you know, with paper decks and projectors. And so one of the big values of private equity is actually gathering the dollars. And if you look at the compensation of the people who work at private equity funds, 50% of the economics of the profit sharing goes to the people who can raise the money. Mm-hmm. So it's actually a lot of private equity's value was access to dollars at scale. So that's one. And then two, finding deals. Back then, deals were actually often off market. So they weren't put to auction. They weren't put to brokers. If there were brokers, there were only maybe a couple people bidding, very inefficient. So the price could be very wrong, or there could be hidden value. You think it's worth X, but you could convert it into something else. So lots of hidden opportunity. And then data, right? The kind of data people could have then, like there would be different insights that you could have information that most people didn't have. Inside information was very common. And as you probably imagine, much less common now. So there were the Warren Buffetts of the world, these people who could really produce alpha, incredible returns by looking at unusual data, being able to understand where to find deals and be able to raise that money. So the value proposition was extremely clear and strong. So the compensation that they receive at the private equity aggregators and operators, that compensation structure was set and crystallized in a period when it was very justified.
We should turn now to talking about compensation. During that time, they put in place a compensation structure that actually involves a few different components. They get paid on the management of their investors' money. They also make some money depending on how profitable the investments turn out to be. And then they've got some other strategies that are a little bit more contemporary now as well. But what should we know about that compensation structure for how private equity firms made money? And as you said, back then, justifying how much money they got paid. Nowadays, I think your argument is harder to justify this compensation structure.
Or the value they're creating is different than what used to be the case. So the handle is 2 and 20. That's what people in industry say. They say 2 and 20. That means 2% annual asset management fee and 20% of the profits, a minimum return hurdle. So the basic idea was, hey, if you're really good at making profits, really good at basically generating returns, upside, you should get a share of those profits. And that was typically 20%. And that was true with the private equity fund manager. And also the operator, the person on the ground, that operator would also get at least 20% of the profits and some asset management fees. So you're actually talking about 2 to 3% asset management fees across that value chain plus 40% of the profits. And then the aggregator also has, whether if JP Morgan's aggregating it or a pension fund, they're also charging some amount of asset management fees and often some kind of commissions or there's advisors. So the total value chain is taking about half of the return, certainly 6, 8, 10% of the total return being paid to that value chain that was created in the 90s. And I just want to contextualize the 20% of the profits, just give people a sense of how much that is. So that 20% profit sharing, it's called the carried interest. It's also called the promote in the real estate industry. And actually in the tech industry, they just call it stock options. Yeah. Right? It's very similar. It's incentivized people. So 20% of the equity is about how much a typical tech company's employee pool, all the employees at a tech company will usually have about 20% of the total equity in stock options. So you're saying the three guys and a dog who are doing the private equity are getting paid the same amount as all the people who work, for example, at Fundrise. The 300 people who work at Fundrise would get about the same amount of the upside as the private equity investor or the venture fund. So that just gives you a sense of how much 20% adds up to.
Let's try to tie all this together then, because we've discussed a lot of different elements about the private investment landscape here. One big trend we've discussed is that there is so much more competition for all of the different investment firms in this space that it's harder for them to gain the same kind of returns that they could in the past. And in fact, we can see that they have had average returns that have been falling for decades now. That is something that has been documented quite clearly. At the same time, they still have the same compensation structure that they had put in place a long time ago. They have still raised a lot of money, and they still exist inside of this value chain that you've described, where a lot of the money essentially gets like nicked away as it makes its way towards the investment that it's pursuing. And so I think this is where we can start talking about like some of the opportunities that this kind of a structure, I think what you've argued is a kind of outdated structure, might create. So where do you see those opportunities and why are they arising now as opposed to sometime in the past?
So what's changed is basically what's changed everywhere, right? The public markets are a good place to look at this. What's happened to the public markets? Gotten more and more efficient. So efficient that the smartest hedge funds in the world can't beat a passive investor. I call it the Vanguard effect. Dollars have become a commodity. Data has become more and more readily available, transparent. Nobody has data other people don't have. In real estate, essentially everybody operates off of CoStar, which is essentially this like database everybody uses. So they're operating on the same data, same dollars, and all the deals go to auction. They're bidding on the same deals. Like a typical deal 2 months ago, 3 months ago, might have gotten 40 bids. So it's basically all the same money going to all the same private equity funds, bidding on the same deals. What does that sound like? It sounds like the public markets, right? It's being bid at an efficient price, and there's no hidden inside data or knowledge about those deals. So it's the market has changed a lot as a result. And the industry has seen a lot of pressure. It's a mature industry. So mature industries usually have fee compression. So 2 in 20 is now 1.5 in 20, and still more compression on that. And the second thing you see in a mature industry is consolidation. And you're seeing two kinds of consolidation in private equity. You're seeing horizontal consolidation. That means funds buying other funds. So Bentall Kennedy is buying Green Oak, and they're now bigger. And the reason that they're doing that is because there's so many private equity funds that the aggregators really just can't choose. So they want to just pick the biggest. So there's this consolidation. And they also want to push on the having lower fees. And basically, you can have lower fees if you have more scale. So you consolidate. And the other kind of consolidation is happening is vertical consolidation. So operators who were experts in Seattle are now raising private equity funds from the aggregators directly, from institutions directly, because they don't need a private equity fund to stand in the middle. And the institution's happy to invest directly into the expert in Seattle. So you have vertical integration, operators going upstream, and you have funds buying operators going, so that fund operators going downstream. So you see the value chain is under a lot of stress because the 6-8% of cost in that chain is getting harder and harder to justify as the markets become more and more efficient.
Okay. And so this is, I think, as you've labeled it, largely a story about technology and software being so good that data is readily accessible and it is just driven a more and more efficient market, which I think usually, by the way, when we talk about markets becoming more and more efficient, that should be good for investors and harder for the companies that are doing the investing, in other words. You mentioned Vanguard a second ago and John Bogle, who was the person who more than anybody else popularized the use of the index fund. He actually once said that his life's work will be finished when even Vanguard's profits are all eroded away by competition. That was his own company. But it sounds like what you're saying is that there's been a lot of resistance inside of private equity to face up to that future, and that's where we are now.
So why? So there's sort of the obvious reason and the less obvious reason. So the obvious reason is it's very profitable. These are multi-billion dollar institutions. It doesn't make sense for them to have less profit. They want to have more profit. That's the obvious reason. But the actual more interesting sort of hidden reason is that there's parts of the value chain that are very resistant to change. So let's talk about aggregators. So the institutional investors, pension funds, insurance companies, banks, sovereign wealth funds. So what do they all have in common? They're all government regulated. Pension funds, insurance companies, banks, sovereign wealth funds, because they aggregate dollars from small investors, the government says, whoa, you have a history of doing bad things. We're going to regulate you. We're going to make sure basically you can only take certain risks and have oversight. You know, you can argue if that's good. The unintended consequence is that things that are heavily regulated by the government are very slow to change.
Okay. So that's where some of the resistance is coming from here. How does that actually manifest as resistance to change? Is it that they're more willing to accept that they'll get charged these big fees by private equity and they're a little bit loath to try something different and more innovative? What exactly is it that manifests as?
I know firsthand. So if you go to a pension fund, the person who works there is like a pseudo-government employee. So you say to the pseudo-government employee, let's do something different means risky. Well, so they have no upside. They don't get any upside profits, options in anything that works to the huge upside doesn't actually benefit the government employee. So they anything with risk only has downside for a government employee.
Yeah, because they get fired if it doesn't work out and it was shown to have been something different from what they used to do, right?
Right. So they get fired if it's different and they don't get any rewards if it's better. So they basically don't want it. And I've actually seen a very large amount of resistance for transparency. It's everyone in the value chain is happy. And so what often happens when a value chain is senescent, is sort of mature, but you know, under stress, maybe ready to go, is change from the outside, not so much change from the inside.
Okay. And I think this might be a good time to essentially satisfy what I imagine is the wishes of all our listeners after that tease we gave at the end of the last episode, which is when we essentially discuss how Fundrise has tried to capitalize on the opportunity that you've witnessed inside of the real estate private equity landscape. So where does Fundrise essentially come into all this? And in particular, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how Fundrise has brought a lot of that value chain in-house. And that's how I understand it, but I could be wrong. So why don't you essentially explain Fundrise's role in all of this?
Yeah, I have a friend who always says, it's all about the windup, not the pitch. So that was a long windup.
That was a very long windup, and here it comes right down
the middle.
That's
my specialty, long windups. So I'm going to do an analogy for a minute, though, because I think people will understand it well if you look at other industries where this happened. So my analogy is enterprise software. What that means is a big company like Intel wants to change their ERP. That's like all their internal HR and accounting software. Mm-hmm. Intel just changed their ERP and they spent hundreds of millions of dollars on that. Hundreds of millions of dollars. The enterprise software companies are IBM and SAP. And that process is a business-to-business process, B2B sales. Why is it a B2B sale? Because it's a huge check. There's a lot of risk. You need a lot of buy-in from a lot of people. It's very slow. And that's basically how fundraising works for private equity. If you're going to go raise money from California state teachers or NYSTER, not New York state teachers, they're going to write a $50 million check. There's a lot of risk, there's a lot of career risk. They're going to move slow and they're going to put it into Carlisle. It's going to be done in meetings. It's going to be done B2B.
I just want to be clear. You're talking about the California State Teachers Pension Fund, right? We're not talking about California State teachers themselves. And they're like, but although it's coming from them, but like, I understand what you mean. You're talking about this enormous hundreds of billions of dollars in assets pension fund that represents the pensions of the California teachers, right? So they're going to raise the money and it's going to all happen through a very traditional process, essentially.
Yeah. And actually, just like enterprise sales, you know, you never got fired for hiring IBM. It was like a saying way back. And so you don't get fired for picking Carlisle. That's like a smart move. So it's really the incentives of the person working at these places, these people, these intermediaries, are not fully aligned with the investor or the actual principal whose money it is. That dynamic of B2B, it's been disrupted in a lot of industries, not just software. And how did it get disrupted? What they basically call now is SaaS. Software as a service. So what does that mean? How does that, why did that destroy enterprise software? So the basic idea is if you open it up to more people, sort of democratize it, right? That will open up a whole new market. They call it the long tail in tech. But to open it up to more people, what do you need to do? You need to standardize it, right? It can't be different for each investor. Manual processes done by people are different for every customer. But if you can standardize it, that means you can open it up to more people and you can then automate it. And once you can automate something, then it doesn't matter if it's $10. Like our software, our machine doesn't care if it's $10 or $10 million. It's just, those are just zeros and ones in the database. So what SaaS did is basically brought technology to more people. Sort of democratized like Dropbox or Netflix is another example. It made it very easy for each person to have software on their phone and what was surprising, I think, to the tech industry, and I think will be surprising to the private equity industry, is that standardized automated software solution ends up over time becoming better than the enterprise software.
Yeah. And to bring that analogy home, by automating, for example, the way that investors put their money into the funds that are managed by Fundrise, then, yeah, an investor can put $10 into one of those funds, just like an investor can put $100,000 or more into those funds. And that way, it helps to democratize access to the funds because you're not just having meetings with people who can put in big checks to you, right?
Right. When someone's writing a big check, you have to, there's a relationship, you have to spend a lot of time with them, there's lots of paperwork. It's a very different process. As you move to an automated process, I remember when I started Fundrise, people told me it was impossible for me to basically have small check writers. They basically said, what's the point? And what they didn't understand is that having everyone anywhere, you could be at home in your underwear at midnight and invest in Fundrise, not in a boardroom and writing a check to Carlyle. Anyone everywhere is more than, bigger than the business-to-business corporate opportunity. And so that's where we started at the value chain, the aggregator. If you basically can control the capital flows, then you can then eat the rest of the value chain. Whoever controls the money makes the decisions. And as long as we were encumbered or beholden to the traditional players, they're not going to eat their own lunch. It's like Innovator's Dilemma, Clay Christensen. If you have a really big profitable business, you're not going to destroy it to start the next business.
The way it sounds like it works then is that there used to be this large value chain, and so that as a dollar would pass through the value chain, it would get nicked away. And it sounds like what you're saying here is that Fundrise has essentially automated a big chunk of that value chain, which makes it possible to charge investors less money as they invest in Fundrise funds, which means that logically, they get to keep more of the returns that they make in the funds. Is that an accurate depiction of what Fundrise aims to do?
That is. And then if you look at a lot of great companies, they have a foothold. They start with a part of the value chain, and then they work their way through the rest of it. So what we're doing, we'll start to roll out, is we've started to write software and take over more of the value chain. So the operator, which is traditionally who you invest in, since that business has become more nationalized, homogenized, we can start to automate that stuff too. So it's not just the private equity fund. It's not just the aggregator. It's all of it. If the whole thing can be put on software infrastructure and over time, more and more of it's automated, then over time, we're building a whole different competing system with the traditional private equity industry. And that system, or just slowly but surely, eats more of it. It ends up being much better than it disrupts the status quo.
So like all that clunky stuff you described from the early 1990s and much of which still exists in like legacy private equity firms, you're saying that the technology has gotten good enough now that if you invest in it and you apply it the right way, that the data is available. You can just apply software to it. And you can now automate away a lot of the stuff that before you would have had to be on the ground finding out for yourself directly by going to the library and looking it up on microfiche or whatever. You're saying that a lot of that is now ripe for disruption. And that's another way that you can further extend the value chain that you bring in-house and that you automate away at Fundrise, right?
I mean, the goal of the software company is to lower that marginal cost to zero. That's what a great software company does. And it's very hard for traditional players to compete with zero. That's what Robinhood did with trading. You saw that like news basically is free. E-commerce destroyed retail. Netflix destroyed sort of traditional cable television. So that's the goal. And I think it's inevitable. The question is, will we be the ones to do it? I think we will. But that's what's so exciting.
Well, I think we've done a pretty good job of bringing this one home and fulfilling our promise made at the end of the last episode. Is there anything that we left out that you'd really want to emphasize for our audience?
Well, so the outcome of all of this technology, all this disruption, right, is to democratize access to this part of the investment world that people didn't have, right? Private markets. And so over time, what I think happens is individuals portfolios start looking like what institutions' portfolios look like. And they have venture capital and real estate, and their portfolios get more stable and actually better returns because those assets are an important part of how you should invest. So this sort of transformation of the private markets into actually a lot like the public markets with everybody investing in it through technology is the future of the private markets. The future of private markets is that they're public.
Okay, nice turn of phrase.
So one question I get about sort of, okay, you said that this is what private equity's value was. What is it now? And the story is that the value of private equity is they pick good deals. That's their value, which was true a long time ago, 10, 20 years ago. But now everybody sees every deal, just like everybody sees every stock in the public market. So what are you doing? So it's actually the value creation is not in the picking the deals and not in the raising the money. Both those things have become more homogenized, commoditized. So there's two values. One is it in the allocation and one in the operations. So by allocation, I mean, if you said, okay, I'm an investor and I'm thinking about a macro trend that is important, like maybe inflation, I say, how do I play that macro trend? Well, with an asset class, what's an asset class to play inflation? Real estate. Okay, so then what's the best product type to play that asset type? Real estate, residential. And then you go to the last port, geography. So where should I invest in that? We say Sunbelt. And so I believe 80 to 90% of returns come from that part of the decision, the macro, the asset class, the product type, the geography. So like a couple more examples, right? So I might say macro trend, technology, asset class, real estate, product type, last mile logistics, industrial buildings, geography, major transportation hubs, right? Or here's the opposite. So if you're so good at picking deals, let's say you picked a retail deal or an office building. Let's talk about how the allocation went against you. Technology, real estate, retail, malls. Didn't matter how good the deal was, you're dead.
Yeah, you're done.
Technology, real estate, office, big coastal cities. Done.
Yeah.
So yeah. So much of the value, I'm saying 90%, and it varies by deal, but so much of it's actually happening, not at the deal level, but the whole story, the narrative, even the story people who work at the private equity funds tell themselves is that they're deal pickers. And that's one of the reasons that they haven't changed is that they don't actually understand what they're doing, what the problem is they're actually solving anymore, because it's changed because the market's gotten more efficient.
Excellent. One final question I have is, do you worry that an approach that is so focused on applying technology and bringing that value chain in-house is also a copyable strategy? Do you worry essentially about competitors also following in your footsteps and trying to do the same thing and starting to erode the edge that you have there in the same way that like the edge in the 1990s was also eventually eroded away?
I mean, obviously I worry about everything.
There's that instinctual downsideriness of Ben Miller, right?
So fortunately right now, we're just so far ahead of everyone else. But I mean, here I am on the podcast telling everybody in the world this is what
sharing
we're
it
do.
With everyone, right? Yeah,
we've had this thinking for years, but we didn't tell anybody until now because I didn't want anybody to realize what we were doing. And now I feel okay. It's going to be hard for them to catch up. They definitely will copy, no question, and they'll claim similar things as us. But the technology ultimately can't lie, and so I mean, it'll be a battle for who ends up winning this prize. But I think that we have a really, really good shot.
All right. Ben, this has been a great chat. Do you want to tease perhaps what you'd like to discuss on the next episode?
Well, my hope is to have another Fundrise voice on the podcast. I don't actually like doing so much of the talking, and I'm one among hundreds. I'll say for the moment, I got to figure out who is the best person to have on with us. So it'll change it up and we'll see how that goes.
All right. So we'll leave the listener with a little bit of suspense about the mystery figure that we might bring on the next episode. Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. Thanks for the great conversation.
Thanks, Carter.
Again, I have been your host, Cardiff Garcia, and I was here with Ben Miller, Fundrise CEO and co-host. Thanks so much for listening, and please send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. And if you liked what you heard, please also rate us on Apple Podcasts and be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. This year's podcast was produced by Seaplane Armada, who also did the music, and by Bizarre Audio, from me and co-founder Amy Keene. And we'll see you again next month. Bye now.